Bad as the economic numbers are, they might not actually be bad enough. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday today, the 16th of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. How many of you, say a month ago, were more than passingly familiar with what's become the iconic economic indicator of this recession so far, anyway, something known as first-time claims for unemployment? No need to raise your hand on this one. No shame in not knowing, because honestly, it didn't used to get a whole lot of traction. It was weekly, there was lots of noise, easy enough to let it slip by. Over the past month or so, though, as you are no doubt aware, that weekly claims number has exploded. As of this morning's report, 22 million people have lost their jobs. And that number is incomplete because state offices are overwhelmed, yes, but as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports to get us going, that is not all of it.
While the number of unemployment claims filed nationwide is a good indicator of the scale of job loss right now, it's likely understating the true level of unemployment. For starters, some people just aren't applying for unemployment benefits, like Darius Brett Windley.
In February 5th, I started tending bar and waiting tables at a little family restaurant about 11 miles south of where I'm at.
That's northeastern Nebraska, where Windley and his wife operate a small farm and produce stand. Working at the restaurant was going to provide extra income until it shut down in mid-March. Windley used to be a union iron worker, and he's been on unemployment before.
It was such a hassle. I would rather take a beating than try and go through unemployment again on a system that's broken down and just not working.
So he won't be counted among the unemployed. Another group of workers isn't eligible to apply for unemployment benefits, immigrants without authorization to work. 28-year-old Yannin Collins is originally from China and now lives in Texas.
I lost my work permit since early 2018.
Collins' application for a green card is pending. She's been working for an HR firm as an independent contractor, but that's now shut down.
So I don't have income, and I can apply for unemployment.
Some people aren't working or earning income, but they haven't lost their jobs. Nate Edwards is a manager for a national rental car company in St. Louis. In early April, he and many of his coworkers were furloughed. His wife is still working as a corporate attorney, so they have some income.
We have enough saved up. We can cover our expenses for the next couple of months.
He says he won't apply for unemployment unless his furlough turns into a permanent layoff. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Sticking with Mitchell's theme here, for a lot of people in this economy right now, maybe some who've lost their jobs or had a pay cut or something, it is a choice of which bills to pay and which to let slide. And increasingly, rent is the bill that is sliding. But one person's rent is a landlord's mortgage payment. So what happens when those payments don't get paid? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that one.
Like 22 million other Americans, Anthony Davidson has suddenly found himself without a job. He's a dance instructor and a choreographer.
I need to save every penny I can now because I just don't know how long this is going to last, and I don't know how long it'll be before I will have a paycheck again.
He didn't pay April rent, and he's not going to pay May. He's getting unemployment, but it's either use it to pay rent or pay for everything else.
My highest priority with everything is paying the medical insurance because you never know what's going to happen.
At the beginning of April, it looked like 31% of apartment tenants had not paid rent on time. New data from the National Multifamily Housing Council show that some have since paid late or partially, but 16% still haven't paid any rent. That's higher than usual. The numbers may be higher for commercial tenants and in some cities.
Commercial tenants, a lot of them are not paying their rent.
Frank Ricci is director of government affairs for the Rent Stabilization Association, a landlord advocacy group. He says some landlords are working with tenants and evictions have been paused in some places like New York. But he says landlords face expenses too.
I don't think anyone wants to get to that decision point of making a choice between paying your property tax versus paying your mortgage versus making a necessary repair. It's an impossible choice.
Elliot Eisenberg is a real estate economist with Graphs and Laughs, an economic consultancy.
Someone's got to foot the bill here. And now the game is who's best able to get themselves off the hook, if you will.
Some economists have warned that unpaid rents and in turn unpaid mortgages could strain the financial system.
In a normal recession, the problem is bad enough. But here, the speed at which the job losses have come has been so profound. These non-payments become an immense issue because you're losing large chunks of revenue.
A key test will be whether stimulus payments and small business loans and grants will be enough to cover rents due in 2 weeks and beyond. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this day of 22 million people unemployed. Traders kind of knew it was coming, right? So the major indices, of course, gained ground. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Among the many industries being hit real hard by this crisis are movie theaters. Big studios are delaying releases. Nobody's going to the movies anyway, right? AMC, the big chain, is said to be in talks with bankruptcy lawyers. And even smaller theater operators are trying to figure out what their businesses look like if they can't convince a bunch of people to sit in a room with a bunch of other people for a couple hours. Stephanie Silverman is one of those smaller movie theater operators. She's the executive director of the Belcourt Theater in Nashville, Tennessee. She is also one of the 10 people we started talking to for our series about the American labor force, the series we called The United States of Work. The Belcourt officially closed its doors a month ago today, so we figured we'd give her a call and check in. Stephanie Silverman, it's good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you, Kai Rizdahl.
So first of all, professional stuff aside, how you holding up?
Well, you know, I would say okay. We have a very full house, which is both fun and stressful.
Yeah, house is full. All your kids are home, yeah?
Yeah. A lot of kind of adult kids because we ended up being the landing pad to keep everyone safe for a while. And, you know, it's sweet, but it's a lot.
I do. So other than running that part of your life, now that the Belcourt is closed, what are you up to professionally?
Well, I mean, it's been interesting. Like, as a nonprofit, it's been spending tons of time learning about the CARES Act, trying to figure out what applied to us. And at the same time, we've been able to carry on a little bit with programming and keep connected to our audiences. So we're streaming films online and film education programs on a weekly basis. We have kind of a culty midnight movie program that we've seen hundreds of people participate in. And then I've been, you know, running numbers, making applications, getting my PPP loan in, all of that good stuff.
Well, so look, number one, how are the numbers shaping up for you? And number two, how's that SBA PPP loan thing going? Because as you, I'm sure, have heard in the news, it's a little bit of a mess.
Yeah. Well, we did, you know, we heard just yesterday that the loan has been approved and funded, and I'm still waiting to sign the final paperwork. But that's certainly extraordinary news for us. It just gives us a minute of breathing room and the ability to keep our people paid, which is the most important thing right now. We've also seen pretty tremendous generosity from our community on a philanthropic level, which, I, you know, frankly, as many things do these days, just brought me to tears. Yeah. We saw nearly $40,000 come in to the theater. It was just breathtaking, frankly.
Yeah, no, it's great. Let me back you up for a minute. Keeping your people paid. You are paying your people even though you've been closed for a month-ish?
Paying the people, yeah. Luckily, we have banked our savings for many years. It's hard to get your head around using your emergency funds, but if not now, when? So we're spending them down.
We talked, the very first time I talked, we talked, actually. One of the things we talked about was the value that you and society really put on the communal experience of going to see a movie together. And one of the things that gets talked about a lot now when we talk about reopening this economy is, man, are people really going to want to go to a crowded movie theater? What does reopening look like for you, movie theater operator?
Yeah, you know, well, I've been thinking about it a lot. And I think in some ways we learned some good lessons as we were closing down about how we would reopen, which includes social distancing kind of baked into the way we sell tickets. So instead of selling, you know, our biggest theater seats 332 people. We will probably only sell 40% of the tickets in that hall so that people can be appropriately away from each other. You know, we're just very cognizant that the ramp up for us is going to be probably more towards the tail end of whatever kind of recovery looks like. But that being said,
yeah,
I don't think everyone's going to want to stay at home and watch Netflix forever. I think they're going to want to come out and see a movie on a big screen.
You got that right. Stephanie Silverman is the executive director of the closed but still operating Belcourt Theater in Nashville, Tennessee. Stephanie, thanks a lot. Good to talk to you.
Thanks, Guy. Take care.
You too. To absolutely nobody's surprise, data from Yelp show that food delivery orders have doubled since this outbreak started. Dine-in service is, of course, a distant memory, so the restaurant business is almost entirely delivery, and some of the cracks are starting to show. Restaurateurs say fees charged by delivery services are just too doggone high and are hitting their bottom line. Marketplace's Jasmine Garst has that one.
Chef Ashish Alfred is a classically trained chef who owns several restaurants in Maryland. For years, he never had a problem with delivery apps. He just saw them as bringing in more business. With the coronavirus outbreak, Alfred now relies solely on takeout delivery. And with apps that charge as much as 40% in fees,
it's a huge, huge chunk of our money, especially because, you know, people are just, for the most part, using this money to pay their staff.
A class action lawsuit filed earlier this week alleges that companies like Grubhub, Uber Eats, and Postmates charge restaurants exorbitant fees, which in turn force restaurants to hike prices for people who dine in. We reached out to Grubhub, Postmates, and Uber Eats. They offered no comment. Douglas Miller is a lecturer at Cornell University. He understands some of the difficulties small restaurants have right now, but he says they have bigger problems than app fees.
For most independent small restaurants, very small margins. So I think them being closed is a bigger issue than using apps.
Meanwhile, Alfred is one of many restaurateurs asking customers to delete food delivery apps.
Look up your favorite restaurant, give them a call, see if they'll deliver to you. If they won't deliver to you and you don't want to leave your house, then do what you need to do.
Now, several New York City lawmakers are pushing for an emergency 10% cap on delivery. San Francisco already passed a 15% cap. Justin Brannan is a New York City councilman.
The mayor and the governor had the power to shut down in-house operations of bars and restaurants during an emergency, so they should be able to use some of those same powers to institute a temporary emergency cap on these delivery apps.
Plenty of restaurants won't make it through this economic crisis. Brennan says there's no need to squeeze them even harder. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
Coming up.
So this is a security map produced by the Homeowners Loan Corporation in 1938.
And what that map said 80-something years ago affects this country to this day. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials was up 33 points today, a 10th percent, ended at 23,537, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ grew 139 points, that's 1.6% there, 85.32. The S&P 500 rose 16 points, about a half percent, 27.99. United Airlines tumbled 11.4% today. The carrier's cutting its May flight schedule by 99.0%. Falloffs also hitting plane makers. Boeing dropped 8%. Its European rival Airbus dipped 2.9% today, apparently looking at requests from airlines to defer aircraft deliveries. Bond prices, yield on the 10-year T-note down to 0.61%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You know, there is a certain rhythm to business and economic news. Government reports like the one we started with today, initial jobless claims, They come out on a regular schedule. So too do corporate reports. Every 3 months, we spend some time on this program talking about earnings announcements. Usually, it's the headline numbers, profits and losses. This quarter, though, as we start getting the first announcements of the pandemic era, we can forget about profits for a whole lot of companies. Losses are likely to be a given. And as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, by digging just a little bit deeper, you can find some useful clues as to the coronavirus effect.
One important indicator of a company's health is how much cash it has on its balance sheet. Donna Hittrich teaches at Columbia's business school. She says having a lot of cash on hand helps a company keep the lights on.
Cash gives you time. You can think about your higher order needs, right? Rather than just survival.
Earnings reports also reveal how companies earn money, whether it's in cold hard cash or in debts and IOUs. Hittrich says investors will be paying close attention to cash flow and whether a company's business model can continue to generate cash through the crisis.
If I have two companies, right, one does most of its sales on credit and another does most of them on cash. I don't know, I'd rather invest in the company that does most of their sales on cash.
Many companies are trying to free up cash that they've been spending on share buybacks and dividends.
Every moment to look at my screen and see another company that is canceling its dividend.
Francis Donald is an economist with Manulife Investment Management. Ford, Boeing, and the sportswear giant Adidas are just some of the companies that have canceled dividends recently. Last month, AT&T, Wendy's, JPMorgan Chase, and other big banks canceled share buybacks.
And it does really highlight how difficult this environment is.
You can also learn something about this economy by comparing a number of earnings reports side by side. For instance, Jim Vogel at FHN Financial says earnings reports can paint a picture of how consumers are spending.
Are people spending money on autos? Are they spending money on improving their home offices?
Vogel says other indicators of how companies are doing come from what's said during conference calls when earnings reports come out.
People will hunt through for keywords and begin to try to compile impressions about what's happening in the economy, focusing not on the numbers, but on what people are saying.
Analysts are especially eager to hear about how executives are thinking about the long term. Omar Aguilar is CIO of Charles Schwab Investment Management.
And I'm sure that analysts and analyst calls will focus on, you know, when do they expect the recovery to begin and when do they expect their companies to just be able to recover.
The Securities and Exchange Commission is encouraging companies to disclose how efforts to fight COVID-19 could change their operations and what steps they're taking to protect their employees. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
While there are a whole mess of unknowns about this crisis, what's becoming more clear by the day is that the pain is not going to be shared equally. Wealth is going to determine a lot about how people get through it, everything from what kind of health care they get to how they can ride out losing a job. The average white household in this country today has nearly 10 times the wealth of the average black household. And one reason for that goes back almost a century to something called redlining, the practice of restricting lending in certain neighborhoods based on race. Redlining has been illegal for decades now, but an exhibit that was touring the country before, you know, everything, it shows how racist housing policies continue to shape this economy. Marketplace's Amy Scott checked it out.
My guide is Nathan Connolly, a history professor at Johns Hopkins and an expert on race and capitalism. We met back when we still could meet face-to-face at Impact Hub Baltimore, a social justice-oriented incubator, to walk through the Undesign the Red Line exhibit. We started in front of an old street map of the city, one of hundreds created around the country.
So this is a security map produced by the Homeowners Loan Corporation in 1938.
The Homeowners Loan Corporation was a federal agency, part of the New Deal, created to refinance mortgages at risk of default because of the Great Depression.
And it illustrates what real estate assessors considered to be the riskiest and safest investments in the city of Baltimore in that time period.
Areas colored green were considered the safest places to invest, then blue and yellow. Areas in red were considered the riskiest. based on things like the age and quality of the housing stock, people's occupations, and the racial makeup of the neighborhood. The exhibit includes a copy of the form assessors used.
There's a separate entry on every single area description form, 5D, that just says Negro, yes or no. And the answer to that question would determine oftentimes what a neighborhood's value would be.
By the time the maps were drawn, Baltimore was already heavily segregated because of racist zoning laws and neighborhood covenants. Most of the inner city near the industrial harbor was red. Connolly says that line first determined who could get mortgage relief and keep their homes, and eventually who could get new mortgages.
So the combination of rapid defaults and the refusal to issue new mortgages is what created a pretty sharp asymmetry between areas that were considered to be good for single-family home occupancy and those that were really primed for predatory forms of rental entrepreneurship.
People often assume that redlining kept investors away, when in fact, speculators piled in, buying up homes and charging inflated rents to families they knew had few options.
And so there was a lot of capital, in fact, dumped into so-called red areas, but in ways that was about harvesting the highest returns on rental investment.
Redlining was eventually outlawed by the Fair Housing Act, signed by President Lyndon Johnson in 1968.
We have come some of the way, not near all of it. There is much yet to do.
Even now, a timeline in the exhibit shows how over the decades, redlining paved the way for urban decay and white flight, mass incarceration, the foreclosure crisis, and the gentrification of today, and how all of that has prevented African-American communities from building generational wealth.
And the exhibit unpacks kind of the policy history. How did we design structural racism and design inequality into cities and places in ways that it really has never been undone?
That's Braden Crooks, one of the creators of Undesign the Red Line. The exhibit has appeared in New York, Des Moines, L.A., and dozens of other cities where the official lines have disappeared, but the racial and economic divisions remain.
There were 239 maps made. It was really ubiquitous across the country.
Undesign the Red Line has been used in campaigns for anti-discrimination legislation and affordable housing, which is becoming even more of a crisis because of the pandemic. At Impact Hub Baltimore, the exhibit is a backdrop for the work social entrepreneurs like Candace Chance are doing to build a new legacy. In her neighborhood in West Baltimore, empty storefronts and hollowed-out row houses still mar the landscape.
And that is indicative of some of the pervasive residue of redlining.
But there are also freshly painted storefronts and affordable condos under construction. Chance is working with a Black-owned development company that's bought several vacant buildings with a plan to create jobs and sustainable home ownership in West Baltimore.
Because redlining was an intentional design, we have to intentionally undesign that through how we look at, you know, working with other folks who have the same mindset.
The idea is to build wealth within the community, not extract it. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, it's more of an observation, really, prompted by news that governors of a group of Midwestern-ish states, Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Illinois, Indiana, and Kentucky specifically, news that they are going to work together to figure out how and when to open their economies. You roll that in with the news earlier this week that California, Washington, and Oregon out here on the West Coast are going to do the same thing, as are seven states in the Northeast, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Delaware by name, and that is a big deal. Now, why list all those states individually, Kai? Because honestly, long lists are not good radio. But I mention it so that I could tell you I looked it up at the Department of Commerce. Those 17 states, which are going to decide together using health policy guidance when and how to open things back up again, they by themselves make up more than half of this entire $21 trillion economy. Okay, gotta go. Dow Industrial's up 33 points today, a 10%. The NASDAQ up 139 points. That's 1.6% there. The S&P 500, 16 points to the upside, about a 0.5%. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, Rick Carr, and John Gordon are the Marketplace editing staff. Betsy Streisand is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.